All right, you're listening to Democracy Watch, the News Collective's weekly news report, bringing you alternative and undercovered current affairs from Vancouver and the Lower Mainland. My name is Alex DeBoer.
I'm Zachary Tharp.
I'm Arman Rana. It's Thursday, September 26th at 5:06 p.m. We're broadcasting from UBC's Vancouver campus on the ancestral, traditional, and unceded territories of the Hankamenam-speaking Musqueam people.
On today's show, we're bringing you coverage of the 2019 Union of British Columbia Municipalities Convention, also known as the UBCM. The UBCM is the annual meeting of BC's municipal and provincial leaders, and this year it took place in Vancouver at the Vancouver Convention Center.
But first, we'll be taking you downtown to the site of multiple strikes happening at four luxury hotels.
That's right, Armin. My name is Zach Tharp, and I'm a new member of the News Collective. I recently heard about the Unite Here 40 strike happening at a few hotels in downtown Vancouver and thought it would be an interesting first story to report on. This strike has been taking place at the Westin, Pinnacle, Georgia, and Hyatt hotels in downtown Vancouver since last week. Though hospitality and hotel workers have been in negotiations with hotel management for more than a year, this Tuesday, I went downtown to talk with the workers and hear what they had to say.
Let's take a listen.
Hello, my name is Zachary Tharp. I'm a reporter here with CITR News. On Tuesday, September 24th, I headed downtown to check out a couple of strikes happening at the Hyatt Regency and the Pinnacle Hotels. After months of negotiation, stalled agreements between the hotel management and the union representing hospitality and hotel workers, the Unite Here 40, has just led to striking. I'm here in downtown Vancouver at the Hyatt Hotel trying to meet with the strikers here that are protesting their unfair wages. In order to communicate their demands, which in addition to higher wages includes safer workloads and working environments, sufficient retirement benefits, and stable full-time jobs, these unionized workers march in front of the hotel. They were shouting, chanting, and holding up signs reading "On Strike." Overall, the strikers seemed to be in good spirits. I arrived at the Hyatt around 6 p.m., and the strikers I spoke with said they'd been there all day. Many had hoarse voices from chanting, but one lady named Jean decided to speak to me.
Hello, Jean. I'm Zachary. I'm here from CITR Radio, and we'd like to hear about your story about the strike going on right now.
Okay, so we are like now four hotels in downtown Vancouver. We're going on strike for job security, benefits, and safety in our workload.
So how long have you worked at any of these hotels?
I've worked with the Hyatt Hotel for a year now, but I am a rehire from them. So the company is very good. I mean, like the management. It's just that we are asking for a better contract this time.
What was your role at this hotel?
At the hotel, I am a second cook at the culinary department. And fairly, we do long hours, and sometimes we don't do our breaks. And what we're just asking here right now is just a fair job security.
And how have you felt like how the negotiations have been going over the past 8 months?
It's been actually 14 months.
14, wow.
Yeah, 14 months. So it's been a long time, and we seem like we haven't found a middle ground to get it settled.
What would you need to happen to have the strike end?
We would like to see it to end very soon. If it's tomorrow, it'll be great. But again, management hasn't come and approached us to sit down for a new negotiation.
Okay. And I heard that Councilor Christine Boyle came by, as well as Premier John Horgan. How did you feel to have their support?
That was definitely a good support from the premier. At the same time, the BC Labor Board has actually picketed with us yesterday. So that is another ump for us to see that, like, we are getting somewhere with our strike, with our fight.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you.
As Jean stated, the general public has joined the cause of Unite Here 40 and the workers on strike, but management hasn't come forward to work on negotiation. When I asked about the strike, management had no comment. I was, however, able to speak with another couple strikers, including someone named Ben.
Ben, nice to meet you. How long have you been working here at the Hyatt? Do you work here?
3 months.
And what is your job exactly?
Bellman, concierge, and sometimes valet.
Okay, and how many hours do you have, like, work a week?
Hours per week?
Yes.
40.
40? Okay. A good amount. I bet it's pretty tough already. And why are you striking?
At this location, it's basically because we've been working for 14 months. Not me, obviously, but the other people, they've been working for 14 months without a contract. And I've been working for 3 months without a contract. And we want our management to sit down and give us an actual decent contract. And they're not doing that, so we're on strike.
After checking out the Hyatt, I headed for the Pinnacle Hotel, just a 5-minute walk away on West Hastings and Thurlow Street. You can hear some of the energy outside the Pinnacle Hotel where more workers were striking. Many were fed up with the way the hotel's management had been treating them.
Yeah, I mean, this is an industry that makes gigantic profits. And they are saying to the workers, yeah, we're going to screw you over on workloads and wages and workplace safety. We're going to try to make you do more work than is safe. We're going to try to get, you know, 100-pound women to move gigantic beds all by themselves. It's pretty awful. I don't know, the Hotel Georgia at least has also been really awful on their sexual harassment policy. You know, they're not banning guests who are, you know, sexually harassing or assaulting workers. They are not, they're refusing to put panic buttons in the rooms, which the workers are demanding. And they're also, you know, screwing them over on wages and such.
I was able to get inside the hotel to try to speak with the hotel manager, but he was not present. I gave them my card, but they didn't comment in time for broadcast. The final striker I spoke with at the Pinnacle seemed to embody this movement.
Safety on the job. Right now, they have security guards watching us on the outside. And when I'm at work, they have no security guards to protect me on the inside. I think that's street people confiscated stolen property from them, and we have no security guard. We have no job security. And we need fair wages. I have 3 jobs to make ends, and many of these people have many jobs to make ends. The hotel owner has 5 hotels, and he won't sign a contract with this union.
Wow. That's incredible. And what job do you happen to hold here?
I'm a banquet server. So we set up for banquets, tables, chairs, serve the meal, clean it up afterwards, and set for the next one, day in and day out.
And how long have you been working here?
I've been here 10 years. Some of our staff are as old as the hotel, 30 years and 40 years staff seniority.
Wow. Making me look young already. So.
Well, I'll try and use modern English.
So what could happen for you to stop striking here? What would you like to happen?
We need the manager to sign the contract. We have a fair proposal to the owners. Most of the owners have agreed. This owner at the Pinnacle Hotel will not sign the contract. He wants to pay us less than the other hotels.
Have you been hearing about the support, and how does that make you feel that you have public support now?
We know that it's noisy. And some people don't like the noise, but the attention it brings helps us. John Horgan came out and spoke with us yesterday. Today, the Minister of BC Labor came and spoke and expressed his support also. We're confident we can reach a settlement.
If you just tuned in, I'm Zach, and you're listening to Democracy Watch on CITR 101.9 FM. We just heard a story on the Unite Here 40 strikes happening downtown. For now, the strikes seem to have no end in sight.
Thanks, Zach. We're going to take a short ad break, and we'll be back with some exclusive coverage of this week's 2019 Union of BC Municipal Municipalities Convention. Stay tuned.
It's very exciting. Yeah. Stay tuned.
Have you ever thought about going abroad to study, work, volunteer, or learn a new language? Mark Sunday, September 29th in your calendar and get down to the East Building of the Vancouver Convention Center to find out how. All the experts under one roof, top universities, gap year specialists, and student travel organizations. Feature seminar on scholarship starts at 12 noon and expo opens at 1 p.m. Admission is free. Check online at www.studyandgoabroad.com for more info.
Extra, extra, read all about it!
Are you a BIPOC individual at UBC who's interested in journalism? Well, the UBC, UBC official student newspaper, has a dedicated space for you. The UBC staff and UBC journalism students have launched the Canadian Journalists of Color UBC chapter Facebook group. We're also aiming to host meetings, speakers, and workshops in the near future. You can search for us on Facebook or give us a shout at coordinating@ubc.ca.
Crackdown is coming to CITR. Starting August 30th, CITR will be airing the award-winning podcast about Vancouver's overdose crisis, told by drug user activists and supported by research. Crackdown is hosted by celebrated documentarian and longtime drug user Garth Mullins. Catch Crackdown every Friday morning at 8 a.m. here on CITR 101.9 FM.
And we're back. You're listening to Democracy Watch on CITR 101.9 FM. I'm Armand Rana.
And I'm Alex. In the first part of our show, our newest News Collective member, Zach, brought us a story on the ongoing Unite Here 40 strike, which is happening in downtown Vancouver with a bunch of hotel workers at four different hotels.
We're now moving on to our coverage of the Union of BC Municipalities, or UBCM convention. The UBCM is the Union of BC Municipal Governments. The convention was an opportunity for different municipal governments to connect with one another and also to connect with the provincial government.
True. This year, the convention was held at the Vancouver Convention Center. Imagine that. Myself and Armand went there yesterday. It was very exciting. We started out our visit by going to the trade show. I was particularly excited about this because I was like, you know, a municipal convention trade show. I'm thinking like, you know, people selling stop signs, different garbage cans, you know, crosswalk paint. And there was a lot of that. And it was great. It was everything I thought it would be. We talked to someone selling pylons for a while. The person we had kind of the best conversation with was a lady who was selling flags, who owns The Flag Shop, which is a Vancouver sort of municipal institution by this point. It was started by her mother in 1975. So let's take a listen to our conversation with her.
Let's do that.
So we're in the Vancouver Convention Center, which is on the waterfront of Vancouver, on the northwest side, sort of the city, and it's beside the Port of Vancouver.
There's a trade show going on inside. There are a lot of different obscure tradespeople trying to market their products to the cities, I guess, of Vancouver. But it seems a lot of them are really marketing more than maintaining relationships was kind of interesting.
Yeah, it's more maybe to be like, we're still here doing our thing. Don't forget about us.
Yeah, yeah. And I think it's also for the people here to kind of, they're here primarily to observe the, like, the what's happened at the convention and touch base with the...
Right, just keep their kind of fingers on the BC municipal beat.
Yeah. That's what we're doing.
That's what we're doing. The flag booth is bumping, so... would you mind telling us who you are?
My name is Susan Braverman, and I'm the president of the Flag Shop in Vancouver.
So you're based in Vancouver.
I was born in Vancouver. I'm fifth generation Vancouverite.
Oh, wow.
I know, isn't that pretty wild, huh? Yeah.
Yeah. So could you describe what your booth is all about, what you're doing here?
Well, we're the Flag Shop, okay. So, but we're a little bit like Canadian Tire. Do you go to Canadian Tire for your tires or for everything else? So in 1975, we started in flags. And as you can see here, we make municipal flags. And it's just a handful. But we also make street banners. But it all started out of flags. The technology, the printing process all started out of flags once upon a time.
So was it started by your family? Or
my mother started in 1975, and since she was a workaholic and I wanted to see her, I used to come to the shop every day after school. And by grade 8, I was actually training the new staff.
Oh, wow.
And by grade 12, I was cutting glass.
Oh, is it in the same spot it was when your mother owned it?
No. We started out at 4th and... Broadway and Cypress, and then we moved to Broadway and Cypress, and then we moved to 4th and Arbutus. We were there for years, then we moved to 4th and Burrard, and we were there for decades. And 11 years ago, we moved down to Powell and Commercial.
Yeah, you mentioned truck drivers. Are truck drivers some of the bigger consumers of flags?
Oh, no, since the forestry.
Yeah, no, I'm just talking about the fact we're going to have a bunch of trucks outside at 3 o'clock, and I'm not sure if I'm going to make it to choir on time. Yeah, because I've been doing this show since 1990, so every other year we've been here. So I love coming because you get to see the same people, but it's quite interesting because it's the lowest turnout at the trade show portion, at least this year. Yeah, it's really it's bizarre
because of the forestry.
I actually can't say why. I'm definitely not qualified for that.
Okay.
No. It's bizarre because usually we have two people working at the booth because there's that many people coming through. And I just told the others not to come in because they can do more there and I can just sit down and work. And, you know, I'll be coming to the show forever because we are, you know, municipalities are a part of our bread and butter clientele. So it's not even like our clients are here. It's just that they're a bread and butter. It's the honorable thing to do to be here. Plus, it's a pretty booth, you know, it's always colorful. I mean, we don't, you know, it's, yeah. You know, the next booth next door is about really something important about the sex trade.
Yeah.
Ours isn't, but ours is pretty. It's pretty. It's colorful. Yeah, but this year's show has got the lowest turnout in my memory since we started coming in 1990. It's kind of weird.
And then I was wondering, so you said you've been here since the 1990s?
Yeah.
So could you tell us anything about how the trade show and the convention has changed over time? Anything interesting you've observed?
No. No, nothing. I mean, what I have noticed this year is I haven't seen old faces. I haven't seen familiar. No, it's usually a place like every other year because it might be staff, the admin staff will come or the mayors and councillors will come. But so we'll often see either they come up and say hi to us and we're hugging and saying hello, or you'll see them standing and congregating next to your booth. Like, it's like, I'm not seeing that this year. But no, it's kind of like a family reunion every other year.
You have a really nice booth here as the corner store. Is there any kind of process by which you get assigned different booths?
Yeah, well, no, first come, first serve. Yeah, first come, first serve. And we actually didn't get in early, but I already know the ones that we want, you know. But we like to have a corner booth because otherwise it's actually not fair to other people because we will block them. Yeah, it's just kind of the products that we sell. They kind of are tall and bright. Yeah.
Did you have any flags that you've designed, your company's designed, that really are your favorite or stand out to you?
Actually, I have one. I do with my, so anyway, it's not that we designed this one, but this is really cool because I took the call when the city of Parksville. See, in the old days, flags were supposed to be heraldic. It's supposed to be your castle has the flag up, and that way the guy on the horse can look over and know what that world is all about. Oh, they're into fishing and they're into all of this. But the days, like, if you're driving up the highway, like on Vancouver Island, and you've got a Canada flag and a BC flag, like the way I'm showing this is, I remember the day that Parksville decided to change their flag. That was their old flag, and that's their new flag. And you see, there's still the people that are, oh, this is what flags are supposed to be. Well, you know, like, if we had that mentality, then we'd still all be in horse buggy carriages, right? Because God forbid there should be a car, and we wouldn't have planes or anything like that. So this one here, they sent their artwork in, and it was on a white background, and I submitted the art approval with a different colored background, because I'm like, and it's like, I remember this, my staff going, that's so taboo, like, you shouldn't do that. There, it's a request for quotation, it's an RFQ, and I'm like, sorry, guys, but you're going to have a Canadian flag and a BC flag. You need your flag to stand out just as much, because nowadays it's about tourism and beautification. And so that's one of my little claim to fame. It's like, that was the old and that's the new. And if you drove down, you know, if you're driving up and down the highway, you'll know where Parksville is.
Yeah, it went from a shield kind of to a font and like a nice wavy line, more modern.
So like you see Vancouver's. I mean, I remember like Vancouver, it's, you know, I know what it is. But, like, Surrey has Surrey written on it. Mm-hmm. It's more, you can identify. So, and even Kelowna has it. But I really wish that, and this one here, Peachland, you know.
But, I kind of like that one.
Yeah, but Peachland has two. They've got one that's got this beautiful rose on it, I think. And they've got white, and then this one. And then the mayor wanted the one for his office with the rose on it. Because, the city of Victoria, they've got their shield crest. That is for the city hall, and then they've got one that says Victoria on it. But they also don't let the flag. It's not available to the public. Whereas more and more municipalities, their flag's available to the public, because if somebody wants to spend $110 on a flag, you know, the city of Vancouver, the city of Richmond, I think you should let them. I don't think it's going to be a strip club trying to they're trying to promote your flag. Yeah, but like this is Richmond. And I mean, it means something. But I'd like to see Richmond on it. I mean, like City of Surrey, they've now got a beautification department. I mean, that kind of says something. So, yeah. But my opinions about flags are not, they don't fit the flag. Like, it's not the right way. Flags are supposed to be symbolic. But I also think that if you're spending money and you're spending taxpayers' money, you should kind of do something that's going to promote your municipality. Here you go. Yeah.
Most flaggers, if you, I don't know if people say that.
Flaggy, the most vexillology is the scientific study of flags. So most, we call them vexy lovers or something. Yeah, flagger is actually the person on the street. I know.
Duh,
I know,
sorry.
I'm like, flaggers, oh my God. Like, no, it's the wrong kind. Yeah, most vexy people, vexy flag lovers. Yeah, there's rules, there's do's and don'ts.
Yeah, and they're mostly more old school in like the older
They are more old school, you know, and they take it really seriously. Yeah. Like when Robert Watt was the chief herald, and he designed the city of Vancouver's flag and the city of Richmond flag, and he came into the shop, and I said, Robert, can you tell me what Panto number the green is? He goes, Susan, I pulled her from the Glazier Mills color swatch and said, pick a green. I'm like, oh my God, because he gave us the symbols, and oh yeah, the flag shop designed the city of Vancouver flag. I mean, Rob Watt gave the symbols for it, and we put them together. But he's like, there was no, nowadays it's like, no, it's Panto number 123, not 124. But in the old days, he literally was, pick a color from the flag, from the color chart. Yeah, there is no right or wrong. Yeah. So over the years, and I won't say whose they were, there were a few municipalities that lost their artwork because it was not really lost, but it wasn't digital, and it is now. So they asked me to send the artwork. I would change their colors because the color that they had that was a yellow, that yellow is going to, you want your flag, your yellow to be bright. So I would tweak the colors a bit. They didn't know, and I'm not doing it to be mean. I'm doing it to be, yeah.
You're a powerful person.
Yeah, I'm the flag queen. But it's really true. It's like that Canadian, that like this flag here, you know. It's like that, those colors didn't exist in solid colors, you know. So let's do colors that look amazing when it's flying on a pole, and when it fades will still look amazing. Like City of Richmond's, that wasn't their original yellow. The original yellow, now they switched it. But their original yellow is literally, like Rob Watts said, go pick a yellow. And we had three yellows, and so they picked the brighter yellow. But that one, I mean, look at that one versus that yellow one over there, you know? Like, If that's flying up in the air, you want something that's going to say pow. There you go. Yeah, I'll probably lose all my customers now.
No one listens to our show, so don't worry.
Yeah, so we're okay. Yeah,
I know. I mean, yeah. Well, thank you so much for
welcome.
Talking with
yeah.
us.
You're very, very welcome.
Interesting to learn about that.
There you go, yeah. And you did grab a butt, happy face button,
yeah,
right?
I got
Hello. So now we know a little bit more about the making of municipal flags and about the Vancouver Flag Shop. So after Armand and I checked out the trade show, we attended a speech made by the Minister of Municipal Affairs and Housing, Selena Robinson. She spoke to a large group about the NDP, about what the NDP government has accomplished over the last 2 years they've been in power. And it seemed like people generally were impressed. Armand and I spoke with Councillor Christine Boyle after Minister Robinson's address to this group, and Boyle was pretty pleased with what the minister has gotten done so far, and described the plan she laid out for the rest of the administration as ambitious.
So after hearing the minister speak, what did you guys do next?
Well, during our interview with the flag lady, she mentioned a convoy.
Whose name escapes us.
Yeah. She mentioned a convoy of logging trucks who are set to arrive during the convention at 3 p.m. Before the convoys arrived, we spoke to a family of demonstrators outside the convention in support of the logging industry. So let's take a listen to that.
Vancouver Convention, and you have some signs here. One says logs equals jobs. Could you talk a bit more about why you're here and what you're protesting?
Well, we're not really here to protest. We're just here to support the big log convoy that's coming. We're here to support the families that have been affected by the downturn in the economy. It's in the logging industry. It's pretty epic what's happened. So we build logging equipment, and we're just here to show our support for other families because it's going to be a pretty tough winter coming up. So that's why we're here.
And what do you think are the causes of this downturn in the logging economy?
That's a pretty complex question because there's actually a lot of politics in British Columbia logging industry. Like what's going on up in the north, there's many reasons for that. What's going on down here in the lower mainland and on the coast, like we have, the government's raised stumpage rates on top of, which is a tax that we have to pay on logging on Crown land. So they've made it so it's very expensive to log. But then on top of that, the logs that aren't going through the mills that get shipped, the Horgan government's put another tax on taxed our own wood that gets called a fee and lieu tax. So our wood gets double hit, and then plus we're having a fight with the states and lumber markets. So it's a double whammy. It's huge. So.
And do you think to address, what are the things that people here at the UBCM should take away in terms of how local governments or the provincial government should be addressing this?
I couldn't answer that. I would like to see them lower stumpage rates and take that fee and lieu tax away, but I don't know. We'll see what happens, I guess.
What do you think about the, because the provincial government is giving $69 million to forestry workers because of this downturn, but there's been reporting that a bunch of that money is actually coming out of rural
dividend.
Yeah, what is it called?
The Rural Dividend Fund, I believe.
There was a lady just talking about that. She was talking about that, but I don't really know much about that, to be honest with you. So I can't say too much. So.
No worries. And so the logging convoy is supposed to be here around now, isn't it?
Yes. Yeah, they were about half an hour ago. They were at Burnett on the freeway, so they'll be here pretty quick.
Thank you so much.
Yeah, thank you. Take care.
All right, so that was the perspective of a father of a family of four. It was the father, wife, and two young kids. And they work in, or the parents work in the forestry equipment industry. So they were there to show their support.
Yeah, it was interesting. We looked a bit more into like the stumpage rates. And part of the problem seems to be the market pricing system used to set the stumpage rates has
right.
a lag of 12 to 8 months in terms of what data it's using to set these rates. And the system was implemented in 2006 in order to satisfy U.S. concerns that BC was interfering too much in the pricing and basically dumping their wood so as to destroy the U.S. Forestry industry. And given that there's an ongoing dispute with the United States right now, I believe the BC government is somewhat tentative to come in and arbitrarily start changing those rates and changing those processes.
Right, absolutely. And what we heard from multiple people is that this is an incredibly complex issue. And I think you just pointed to one of the reasons it's really complex, because in addition to these stumpage rates, we have environmental factors, trade factors. There's a lot of things going on, so it's very complex. So this family was out there to show their support, and everyone kind of knew at the convention that this convoy would be arriving at 3 p.m. They were a bit late. What did you say? They arrived like 3:30, around half an hour late.
We're actually hearing their ghost of their, like, their whale sounds,
yes,
or something.
I did describe it as whale sounds. You could hear them honking, and it was sort of like a fog of distant honking for, like, 10 minutes before they arrived. And it was sort of eerie and did sound kind of cool, actually. And then once they arrived, actually, on the street right in front of the convention center, it was very loud and sounded more clearly like trucks honking, which is what it was. So as they arrived, kind of everyone rushed over to where they were turning. They turned right at Burrard just before the convention center. I don't believe they were allowed to actually go directly in front of it, which I think they probably would have wanted to. But there were police there and they, got them to turn. So what happened is all these giant logging trucks were turning and honking, and there was a crowd filming them, some people cheering, a lot of people just filming. At first, we couldn't tell if they were just doing loops, because, a lot of the trucks look the same, right?
Yeah.
So we couldn't tell if it was, a million trucks or it's like 10 trucks doing loops. But I did read in the paper today that it was about 200 trucks.
Oh, wow.
So, if that's accurate, we were watching it, and I can't say whether or not that was accurate, because, again, I couldn't tell at some points one truck from another. But anyway, it was quite the spectacle. So we witnessed that, and then we started to walk back to the convention center, and we ran into Councillor Michael Weeb. He is a Green councillor, new on council for this term. Like most of council, yeah. So we wanted to ask him his perspective on this convention, whether he thought it was helpful in connecting with other governments, in what ways it was helpful, and, to talk to him as well about the logging trucks. As you'll be able to hear very clearly in this interview, all the trucks honking. It was incredibly loud. So we asked him a few things. Let's hear what he had to say.
Well, great. Councillor Weeb, how is the convention going so far?
It's going really well. I think this is a great opportunity for us to challenge big ideas and have sit-downs with ministers, other elected officials, to really kind of gauge where we're at on a provincial level, because sometimes I think we have these amazing projects or things we want to do to solve solutions in our communities or our neighborhoods, and someone's already led that work or done it somewhere else. And so I think what this is really good for is really connecting with others that have the similar ideas and find out maybe why it didn't work or what learnings we can do to do it differently, and to share what we've done that's been positive. So I think as City of Vancouver, we might have a larger bandwidth with larger staff to help us out, but some of the municipalities have the ability to be more nimble. So some of them have done things quicker than we've been able to do. And other times we've been able to really gather more data and information that a smaller municipality wouldn't have the ability to do. So I think it's sharing that knowledge, which has been really helpful.
Could you give an example of where you had a learning from this event and you kind of can think of applying it now in Vancouver?
Yeah, one of the ones we're doing is the region, so the lower Fraser Estuary, so this amazing river shed that we're on with the salmon and all the creeks we have in this area, doesn't have a governing body that really looks after it. So we're talking to different municipalities in different areas that have created water boards that can really look at preserving their water and where you do estuary management and where you would put new creeks in and why it's important to deal with rainwater differently. And So we're following what Cowichan's doing with their First Nations. We're looking at what Okanagan's done with their water board. And so I've been really trying to focus on setting something up. So we have a governance model that has industry, First Nations, elected officials, and other organizations all at the same table, ensuring that we are creating a plan to protect our local waterways, because it's really important that we feel connected to the land and waters, and it has to be First Nation led. And so we're looking at smaller municipalities that have been doing that.
Great. I mean, I have to draw attention to what's being drawn attention to. There's obviously all these logging trucks going, turning right at Burrard just behind us, honking their horns. To draw attention to the ailing forestry industry, what are your thoughts on that standing out here?
This is where you really see the difference in the different elected officials that are here, right? That rural-urban divide. But then we've been hearing some good solutions. Obviously, you heard Purple today talking about how we can use wood more in construction. We're seeing that 24 municipalities have used taller towers for wood construction. UBC is one that's done 18 stories, but we saw tons of pictures today of different businesses and our different projects across the province that have used wood. And obviously it's something we're looking at Vancouver. Could we do a 30-story wood structure? Like, can we start to look in that direction to really support the local wood industry? And that is something that we'll be looking for. So this is great to see how much that matters. And then we're also hearing from others saying, hey, we're sending our cardboard outside of the province. Why don't we send that province to a mill and use that to create paper and to create jobs in a municipality that might be losing their jobs? Because we need to recognize that we don't want to leave people behind. We want to make sure that everyone can transition in this new economy. And I think that there are creative solutions, and hopefully we can look at not always just doing things the same, but recognize that we need to have jobs in every community, because we need viable, connected communities for us to feel safe and feel wanted in BC.
Yeah. I'm wondering, this is quite a broad question, but do you think municipal governments should have more power?
That's a tough question, because what is power and what are we, right? Like, because people say, like, do you want us to have more jurisdiction over more things? And there are times that we're asking for more. And so there are abilities where we could say to the province, give us the authority as a city to either do it or not do it. Because sometimes when the province wants to do it province-wide, it doesn't make sense, right? Hailing
sure.
some, right? So what I think we're going to see more and more is the province giving cities the ability to choose or not to choose to do something. And so that means we are getting more power, but sometimes we might not have the capacity to do that. And so to give away all the power doesn't make sense either, because there's regional issues. So I think you have to recognize when it can be used and not used. I think that there is more ability for the province to recognize that they could fund cities to do what they know best, because they're on the ground dealing with the issues. And then there's other times when it's great to have a provincial aspect to it. So I think it's a dangerous question in the sense that it really has to come down to what is the solution we're trying to solve, and can we streamline the siloedness of having provincial, federal, civic, regional districts to make that issue happen. And I think if we could focus more on the issues-based solutions than the actual governance and giving the permits, because I think we get lost in the bureaucracy and saying, we can't unlock that fund because of this, and we can't do that, which the real reason should be, what do we want to solve? We want to get money for this. How do we get that, and who's involved? And the jurisdiction should be a lot easier. And I think that communication's happening more and more.
Right. Okay. So when I say power, if we're talking about things involving funding, money, municipal governments only have property tax and the money they get from collecting fees and permitting and stuff. So you're limited in that capacity. But in something that is something like housing, to do with like rezoning or setting rent controls, things like that, that don't actually involve funding, do you think municipal governments should have more jurisdiction over those kind of regulations, such as in Vancouver, to have different rent control that maybe is a bit tougher and helps renters more, that isn't necessarily needed in a rural community in BC?
Yeah, and we're seeing that. I mean, the city's asked for how we do an empty homes tax, right? And now other cities are saying we want to have that, because Vancouver has our own charter compared to the rest of the province, right? Has a local government act. So for others are saying, well, we want the ability that Vancouver got. So I think that there are times when I think other places should have the ability to get that authority. But some cities don't want to utilize that authority. And that's what I was talking about, where I think, yes, we should try to find ways where, when applicable, cities can have more authority to enact something. that would benefit their community. And I think that is a good thing. And I think the province recognizes that. But sometimes they don't have the capacity to recognize all the needs through the whole province. And so I think we're going to see that more and more. And I think the federal government as well, when we've been working with them, have recognized that as well, is that it's very difficult for someone in Ottawa to really recognize where that funding should go. And so they're trying to find ways to fund bigger amounts that go to the province. And the province is then helping create a fund that the cities can now apply to. And so we're starting to recognize that a federal approach to a lot of the things isn't really working. And on some it is, and some we need a federal approach. But I think what you're talking about is, yes, more cities need levers to deal with the issues they have. And I think we're seeing that happen more and more. And that is a promise that we're hearing at events like this.
So specifically on rent control, do you think that's something that the city of Vancouver, that if it had the power to do it, that it should be considering and it should be actively lobbying the provincial government?
You mean for vacancy control specifically?
So on vacancy control, obviously the city of Vancouver is doing vacancy control on certain buildings. So when we do some of the new rental building projects, we actually have created rent control on certain units. So we do have the ability on certain units to do it. And so the issue is that what is the data science behind it and what do we want to see citywide, right? So for us, we do have an ability in Vancouver to do it. And the goal will be, what would we want to see from the provincial government to help support us to meet the funding gap needed to create the sustainable rental projects that continue to be maintained to a level of standards that we want occupants to live in? And I think that's been a balance. When we see when welfare rates are so low, the buildings become in such poor condition, and so we need to fight to have welfare rates increase. So there's a lot of times there's more than one issue, and I think that's where we've got to work collectively on. The answer isn't, do we want rent control or do we want this? The goal is we want affordable, good housing for everyone. And so what does that look like, and what are all the mechanisms we need to get there?
Well, and sorry, just want to clarify here. Rent control is a number of things. Vacancy control is when the cost of a unit is tied to the unit itself rather than the tenant. So we don't have vacancy control. Where do we have vacancy control?
So all the new rental projects that are meeting the new MERP programs, right? All of those have the rental increases are tied to the unit and not the tenant.
For a certain percentage of them?
Yes. So the ones that are considered affordable. So under the MERP program, we actually have our first view of what it would look like to have vacancy control. So it's what we're going to try. And for the Vancouver, we're not seeing that anywhere else. So this is something that's new. And so people say you're going to have to go from 8 stories to the larger stories to get a MERP project. And some of them are saying, well, you're only getting 13 units in this project. But those are 13 units that have vacancy control that are going to continue to be more and more affordable as they get older. And we need more stock of those. So it's going to be interesting to see how, when we get the data back on how those rents are looking year after year. But it is our first step into what it would look like to have vacancy control.
Yeah. But just generally, the province controls the annual allowable rent increase. And they,
yes.
For example, where was it? Port Moody, POCO, Port Coquitlam, they passed a motion that would take away the business licenses of landlords, right, who evicted tenants. There have been attempts, but they're kind of illegal because the province has jurisdiction.
Yeah, so it's sort of a pilot. Yeah. It's going to be difficult in the sense that right now our certain costs are going up much more than a 2%. And right now our vacancy is so low, right, that we're in a very tough market. And I think right now we need to find out, how do we build ourselves out of this market? How do we put invisible density? How do we get people to put secondary basement suites? Like, how do we do temporary modular housing that you basically can drop in your backyards to put an extra suite, right? So we can do as much as we can possible to really get the affordability there. And then we need to look at what those structures are that we can have it so the rents stay affordable throughout the long, right, as long as the building is there. And how do we ensure that the property owners, because we have really good property owners, and I really don't like when we try to combat property owners against property or vacancy control, because there are some that haven't raised rents in 10 years. There's some that really are trying to do the right thing, and we need to make sure that the buildings are sustainable and they can make a business out of it. And so we have to balance the two. And so that's, for me, is there are mechanisms we need to put in place, and I think the main goal is we need affordable secured rental, because that's what people want. People want to make sure that they're not going to get rent evicted. They're not getting booted out. They're going to pay the proper rents. And if they do leave the city and come back, that there's a place that they can rent that's going to be an affordable rate. I mean, that's what we need to go, and that's our main goal. How we get there, there's different views right now, and we're going to continue to get as much data as possible, and we want people to advocate as much as we can to recognize that it's not acceptable to pay 50% of your income on rent. You can't be sustainable that way.
So we heard earlier today the Minister of Housing and Municipal Affairs, you know, make the case about what her government's been doing for the last 2 years. What were your takeaways from her presentation?
She did a lot of kind of explaining on what's been going on across the province. So I think what I really liked about her takeaway is kind of the provincial look at it. So what's happening in each component of the province, recognizing that we all have such different needs. I think that's why UBCM is so important, is sometimes you can get kind of stuck in what the needs are of your city and not recognizing that housing is such a regional thing. So when you looked at Burnaby and you're looking at how little rental housing they had developed and how much they were taking off the market, it really hurt Vancouver. So I like a lot of the work she was doing. I think it was pretty impressive to see everyone stand up at the end and kind of give a standing ovation to the work she's doing. However, there's a lot of people that said there's still a lot of work to do, and there's a lot of gaps, and there's things that weren't brought up today that people are hoping to see that weren't there. And so as much as this is a good step forward, and there were some positives today, there's a lot of work to do to really get people housed.
Can you give an example of something that was not brought up that's a potential gap?
There's tons. I mean, I just had a meeting from there to BC Assessment, and one of the ones we're looking at is there's definitely a gap on the affordability of commercial spaces and doing split taxation, so we could kind of split that, and that wasn't brought up at all today. So being able to split a class, even for residential, can make a big difference of really saving some of the older stock we have that is getting pushed out or getting redeveloped because of highest and best use. And that was a gap I noticed today. And we had a good talk with BC Assessment because we need to protect some of the older stock we have. And that's in commercial affordability and residential affordability. And that was missed today.
I was reading about this because this is the city of Vancouver approved a tax shift.
Yes.
Because they did not believe that they were going to get they were not optimistic about getting a tax split this year, right?
Yes.
Are you optimistic about the province implementing a tax split in the near future?
So that's what I'm saying, that we didn't hear that today. And I didn't hear even that's something they were looking at. And so that's something that we'll be advocating for, because it is a big gap. And if we want to keep our cultural spaces, if we want to keep our affordable old rental stock, if we want to keep kind of the legacy businesses that keep our neighborhood strong, we really need this. And so it will be something that the City of Vancouver and a lot of councillors will be advocating for. And we had some good talks today with BC Assessment, because there might be some options for us to ask for changes to our Vancouver charter that could give us an opportunity to start to do some targeted work on this. And I will be advocating for that in the next little bit.
So do you think it's more of an implementation thing in terms of the timeline, that the city, the province feels like it needs more time to implement this, or they are just opposed to the concept of making these changes?
I don't think they're opposed. It is very complex, and so it's not something you can just easily do, and it's, I think, taken a while for even all the elected officials to really get an understanding of what it means, and because who benefits and who doesn't. I mean, it's going to change a lot of funds and the way things go, and so I think it's going to happen. We just, I think, need to recognize the complexity of the issue and that we need to deal with it, and that's why I do like that Vancouver is doing a tax shift for the next 2 years. Because we do need to recognize that our commercial properties need to be helped out. I mean, you can't have a complete walkable community without having the needs in your community. And so if your laundromat leaves and you don't have laundromat in your building, you're going to now drive to a laundromat? Like, that's not acceptable. If your dog daycare has to move out of your neighborhood and you don't have an opportunity to walk there and you're now being forced to put a car, that just changes the whole way of what Vancouver is. And we're a neighborhood city, and we need to protect that.
Yeah, it links up with climate change.
Yes.
Yeah.
And obviously that's one of the big climate goals, is we need walkable, complete communities. And without recognizing that this is a huge component of that, you need to have the things you need on a daily basis within a walkable scale from your house or your business. And I think we're moving away from that if we don't start to support our affordable commercial spaces.
Yeah. Well, thank you for talking with us.
Thank you. And hopefully you got something without the loud honking.
Yeah, I'm not sure.
In the context of Vancouver's opioid crisis, CITR would like to take a moment to share some harm reduction strategies.
Try not to do drugs alone. When going out, let friends know what drugs you're taking and make sure someone has an naloxone kit. If you're able to, get your drugs tested before taking them.
Avoid mixing opioids with alcohol or stimulants. Remember that opioids can include painkillers prescribed by a doctor, and it's possible for any drugs to be contaminated with opioids.
Learn the signs of opioid overdose, which include, but are not limited to, unresponsiveness or unconsciousness, inability to speak, breathing that is slow, erratic, or has stopped completely, heartbeat that is slow, erratic, or has stopped completely, skin tone that has turned blue or gray, choking or gurgling sounds.
If you think someone is overdosing, call 911 immediately. Start rescue breathing and administer naloxone if you have it. You cannot get in trouble for being on drugs, so always call 911 in an emergency.
For more information about naloxone kits and training, visit towardtheheart.com.
Thank you and stay safe.
All right. If you just tuned in, you're listening to Democracy Watch on CITR 101.9 FM. We're just wrapping up our show for today, and we're going over coverage of this year's UMBC, which is wrapping up on this Friday.
Have I been saying it wrong the whole time? UBCM? Oh, it's UBCM.
My bad.
No, that's okay.
UBCM.
I always mix up letters myself, so I thought I probably had been saying it wrong. That's right. We have been. And so you just heard an interview that myself and Armand did with Vancouver City Councilor Michael Weeb. So there were a couple interesting takeaways from that, I thought. We have a couple minutes. We'll just kind of spitball them. So I asked him about whether municipal government should have more power. I framed that pretty broadly. Rookie mistake. But then when we started talking about the specifics of rent control and vacancy control, he said that, oh, we do have vacancy control. I didn't know that. So what he's saying is that under MRRP, which is the Moderate Income Rental Housing Pilot Project, which was passed in late November of 2017, it's a project we've covered on the News Collective. There's an episode about it in Seeking Office. Take a listen through the feed or look through the feed for it if you're curious. But it's a project that incentivizes developers to build rental, just like Rental 100, which is another project. Another incentive for developers to build rental, because often developers can make more money building condos, so why would they build rental? So the city says, okay, if you build rental, we'll give you, you know, you have to pay less of these fees, we'll do blah, blah, blah for you. They make it appealing to them. It makes sense. So with MRRP, 20% of the units that are included in MRRP projects have to be built for moderate income people. So that's people making 30 to 80K. And those units are rent controlled or have vacancy control applied, which means that they only go up the annual allowable rent amount every year. So right now the province sets that rate. And that's what I was saying, like should things like that be controlled by municipal governments rather than the province? That's an example. But right now the province sets it. So every year, all of our rental, all the rent we pay in whatever suite you're renting out in BC is allowed to go up by 2.5%. However, if you move out of your unit, your landlord can hike the rent on your unit for the next person by any amount, right? And we see this all the time. It's a huge problem. So what I was asking is, should municipal governments have more power to deal with things like that? Because this is a much bigger problem in Vancouver than it is in, you know, the District of Wells, which we talked to someone from that district. It's a 250-person town outside of Barkerville. So, he was like, yeah, we have vacancy control. We're seeing how it's going. I mean, okay, like, sort of. I'm not even sure if any of the MRRP buildings, because the pilot project is so new, I'm not even sure if any of them are actually have been built and are functioning yet. I know some have been approved. But I mean, I don't really know if that's going to be a great example of like, how is this 20% of like, you know, maybe 10 buildings in the city going to give us an example of how vacancy control works? It kind of seems like an excuse to avoid, dealing with that topic. I don't want to bring up his comment about doggy daycare, but I know personally when my doggy daycare moves and I have to take my Mercedes to find a new one, it's a true inconvenience. Just kidding. I mean, I felt that was a little bit of a class comment there when he was talking about the split property tax assessment, which is something that the city is hoping to get, which makes a lot of sense. Basically, they believe small businesses are being pushed out of the city because we tax buildings for tallest and best use. So you might have a tiny little store you've had for like 2 decades, it's been passed down or more decades, and now that area is zoned for like a taller building because the area is gentrifying, whatever. You can't, so you're taxed for a tall building, a big building, even though you have a little one. So anyway, so they're trying to change that, and thus came the doggy daycare comment.
I think it comes from an example that Pete Fry brought up. One of his friends or something.
One of his friends. Oh, yeah, Pete's friends, yeah.
Owned a doggy.
Counselor Fry, yeah.
Yeah, owned a doggy daycare and they had to move out of the city or something. And that's what motivated Pete Fry to vote in favor of the
tax. Yeah, I've heard him talk about that. It was specifically a doggy daycare?
I think so. It has something to do with dogs.
I think he just meant, it's possible he just meant like, you know, a place you drop your dog off when you go out of town, but it sounds like a spa or something. You know, it sounds really bougie.
Is it just because Counselor Weeb is saying it? Or?
I mean, I don't think you'd hear Gene Swanson saying that.
Yeah, that's true.
Do you? I mean, I don't know. What did you think about what he had to say about, for example, the logging truck convoy?
Yeah, well, I think it was interesting. I think, as you said earlier, it's a very complicated issue, and he was grasping that as well. And I think that's what everybody is just saying that. But I think they also see that the industry is really suffering right mm-hmm. now, and they want to find ways and means to kind of assist in some way. And yeah. I think this whole convention was a way for people from, you know, all over BC to kind of bring their concerns in some way to the, you know, the urban community that's more kind of in tune with the province and, you know, has more capacity and resources to often to look into things and deal with things.
Yeah, totally. Yeah. I mean, yeah, it's a great opportunity for rural and urban areas to meet and overlap because we, you know, live in this huge province and this huge country and there's so many different things going on that are so literally geographically far apart that, yeah, seeing those trucks at the convention was a great example of the overlap that we don't see enough of. And, so that just in conclusion, I guess, so you know, the convention ends tomorrow. So it was happening this Monday through Friday. It's a full week. I know I got a press release that the sustainability teens will be protesting outside of the convention center tomorrow, I believe at 12 or 12:30 p.m. As well, there are going to be climate strikes happening in the city tomorrow. They are here at UBC on campus. I believe it begins at 11:30 tomorrow. And then everyone's moving to City Hall, which is at Cambie and 12th. And that is around 1:30 that is happening. So we'll be covering that. The News Collective will be out there if anyone wants to join. Get out there and join.
Thanks for listening on today's show, and we'll be back with more local news next Thursday at 5 p.m.
Thanks for listening. Stay tuned for more CITR programming.